welcome to Film Forum's podcast. The following event was recorded on January 28th, live at our theaters located at 209 West Houston Street in Manhattan.
So here they are, Ethan and Joel Cohen. Don't they deserve a standing ovation after that? So, you guys aren't famous for doing Q&As like this, I hear. Do you look at your older pictures?
No.
You do?
No.
You never do?
Very, very rarely. We had to, I remember, sit through Blood Simple once about 15 years ago, because Fran... It was something connected with somebody giving Fran something or other, and we were so disturbed by it that we went back in the cutting room and cut about 10 minutes out of the movie.
Really? Is that what's on DVD? Mm-hmm. Really? So we can't we're not showing the integral version here? What is the integral version?
Yeah. Well, the whole point was we didn't want you to show that version.
Actually, we're not getting the print from you. We're getting it from Universal. When's the last time you saw Fargo?
When we were working on it. Have you seen it since?
I don't think so.
That's good, because I don't want you tampering with this picture. I think
I saw the credits, though, and we were both looking at it going, oh, yeah, him.
I don't say this much. I think it's pretty damn perfect. I don't know if you agree, but I really do. I mean... This word isn't used much in an art house setting, but it's damn entertaining, isn't it? It's darn good sushi, like in the words of Barack Obama. Any questions from the audience? Wait a minute. Wait for the mic, please.
You've done numerous movies with crime themes, fictional. This is the first one, or the only one that I know of, that you've done based on a real story. What was it that attracted you to the story?
The question is it really based on a real story?
Well, yeah. No, it's not really. Yeah.
Never mind. We wanted to do a true crime story kind of movie, but we didn't know any good true crime stories. So we said it was, and we made one.
You know, it's interesting because there was a reporter for the New York Times a year ago who called me up, and he was writing for an obituary about someone who had committed a murder in Minnesota and had just died, and he insisted that it was what Fargo was based on, and I told him I'd never heard of this guy. And actually, when I looked into it, the story didn't have a lot to do with... And so he published the obit saying that we had used that story as the basis of Fargo, but he also published the fact that I denied it.
There was, in the 90s, there was a husband in Connecticut who put his wife in a wood chipper, so there's that. I remember the police said they recovered the wife, but they said just in time because... one good rain would have washed her away.
And that's it. That's the basis for the picture. Up front, wait a minute. Hold on. We got one back there first. Then we'll do you.
One of my favorite lines in the film is the repetition of, this is my deal here. What does he think about his wife? Like, why is it that he sees the money more so than his wife? Because then he says, this is my wife here.
I'm waiting for the answer to that, too.
you have us at a disadvantage because we haven't actually seen the movie for many years. I don't know. He's kind of a... Does this answer the question? Obviously, he's kind of a hapless putz.
Yeah.
He's the screen's greatest hapless putz ever, I think. Is he based on anyone in particular?
No. You know, that's also interesting because we imagined him when we wrote him as being physically very different from Bill. And Bill Macy, who ended up playing the part, came in originally to read for us for another part. And I can't remember which it was. Maybe it was it the accountant, but at any rate, he said, but, you know, I think I'd like to read the Jerry part. And we said, well, yeah, we're thinking about there, but go ahead. And he did, and we went, okay, well, yeah, you should play that part. I mean, but it was sort of against our preconceptions about sort of what kind of person would play that. We imagined him sort of big and, you know, Bill's very fastidious and trim, and we imagined a guy who was sort of uncomfortable in his body. And but that's a example of an actor coming in and just by really having an interesting idea about how to play the character and being a really good actor, as Bill is, and convincing the people who are making the movie that they should think about it in a different way.
It's really launched his career, I think, didn't it? Up here.
How's it going? I have a quick question about that shot when Jerry's walking out to his car. Is that something you guys came up with, like, in pre-production and created the set around it, or is that something that was already there and you just decided to shoot it because it looked great?
No, it was already there. You mean the very high shot?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we were in some parking lot in Bloomington, Minnesota, and there was... Went up to the top of the building to look down at what the parking lot looked like and decided to shoot that.
Cool.
Over there.
Hi. Was there any, say, one shot or scene that comes to mind? Because there's a lot of just unbelievable locations, like that was just referenced in the last question. Any one scene or shot that really kind of came about or substantially changed from how you wrote it or envisioned it based on the location or the weather or, you know, some kind of external thing that influenced or changed the way you had planned to do it?
Can you remember? I'm sure there was. I'm trying to think of a specific example.
Well, the weather vexed thing because we ended up getting the weather we wanted, but only after a really warm winter with very little snow, and we kind of shot all the interior stuff first because we weren't getting the weather we wanted, and only at the very end. And actually, by moving further north, did we get the kind of what we wanted and what we ended up getting, fortunately, with that kind of thing where there's no horizon, it's just gray. You know, it's overcast, so it's just... dull gray ground and dull gray sky and no horizon. But that was kind of one of those strange things where the plan actually worked out just by, you know, deferring shooting long enough.
Yeah, we were very worried about the weather going in because, if you don't have snow at the right times during your schedule when you want to shoot certain kinds of things which require it, and you have to have a plan B.
I remember thinking... when we shot the parking lot at the airport, it was bitter cold, but it was also clear blue, and we thought, oh, shit. Well, you know, we had to shoot it that day because it was the airport. But mostly we got the,
Mostly we got the weather we wanted. It is interesting, though. It was melting very fast. The nighttime stuff that you see during the murder scene is essentially shot on patches of snow. We only lit where the snow really... All around what's lit there isn't snow there. It's melting. So that was all done in North Dakota, up in Cavalier, North Dakota, about as far north as you can go, right along the border with Canada.
Yeah, that's actually true. That was some like weird Maoist exercise where we shoveled snow to fill the frame.
Oh, let them. Where's the mic?
Hey, guys. Has there ever been a piece of music that you knew you had to put in a particular scene in one of your films, but ultimately it didn't make it because you couldn't get the rights to it or didn't work as well as you thought it would?
I think in Blood Simple there was a... I'm a believer for...
This was good. I was just looking at the credits, as I said, and I remembered there's a Hal David Burt Bacharach thing that works really well in the buffet, and I talked to Hal David's kid who does the licensing, and they were kind of... But that's one that worked out.
Actually, there is a really funny story about a close call with that, but it's the Big Lebowski. It's we wanted to license a Rolling Stones song that was covered in the movie by Townes Van Zandt. And Alan Klein, who owned the publishing rights, ABCO, he wouldn't give us the song. And it was a question of money. No, it's not a question of money. I'm just not giving it to you. So Michael Kuhn, who was the head of Polygram at the time, had been a music lawyer. That's right. Isn't that how we got to him? He asked Alan to come, and he begged him. He said, just come to a screening of the movie and then say no. So we set up a screening for him. He came in. As he approached me, I put my hand out, and I said, nice to meet you, Mr. Klein. And he said, you don't know that yet. And he sat down. He watched the movie. He didn't laugh once until it came to the scene where Jeff Bridges says, he's in a taxi cab listening to Peaceful, Easy Feeling. He says, turn that shit off. I hate the fucking Eagles. And Alan Klein got up. He laughed. He got up hard. He laughed hard. He got up. He walked out of the theater. And on his way out, I was sitting on an aisle there. And he said, you can have this song.
He controlled El Topo, too. We couldn't get it because... Right. Yeah, El Topo and the Holy Mount.
Yes, I have a question.
We need to be near the mic. How about up front here?
Oh, I've got a question here.
Then up front.
Okay. There's a lot I'd like to know about the reasoning and thought behind this movie, but one scene in particular was bringing in Mike Ciccarino's character. And just to refresh your memory, that's the old classmate of Marge, the Asian. And the
what did you think? It wasn't Ciccarino, though.
Yanagida.
Kawakita or something.
Yeah, Mike Yanagida.
There you go.
Yeah, Mike Yanagida. Yeah, he's the classmate of Fran. Yeah. Fran's character in the... And what's the question?
Well, exactly. See, we wanted to do a true crime story, and in those stories, stuff happens not because it's interesting or narratively neat, but just because it's true, so irrelevant things happen. Honestly, that's...
Kind of makes the movie, in a way.
Yeah, it makes it feel like a true crime story.
Exactly. Over here.
I just have a general question kind of about this sense of reckoning that you always have for these kind of anti-heroes. It's very karmic. And there's this one scene where Frances McDormand is heading into town. She's got him in the back seat, and they pass Paul Bunyan, and it's this, you know, this like, it's like he's meeting his fate. So I was just wondering what goes through your head when you're making these films and you have these great anti-characters and this, I mean, do you think about the sense of destiny before? Because it all kind of comes around.
I don't know about that, but that statue was... Rick Heinrichs, the designer, that was really... We kept saying to him, it was as if we'd cut his heart out, because any time he tried to do anything... architecturally and design interesting, we would go, no, we want make it boring and bland looking. except he could make this statue. And he put this statue up in the middle of nowhere in North Dakota. And then for days, people would drive out there at night like a pilgrimage, their kids in pajamas in the back seat, and stare at this thing. So I don't know if that somehow answers your question.
Is Brainerd really the home of Paul Bunyan?
Yeah.
It really is. Yeah. Oh, I never knew that.
And sometimes, do you know what happened to it? Some township, somebody bought it. It was somebody felt its power in that. And actually, I saw Milo's name on the...
Yeah, Milo Derby, yes.
Dolly Grip took the wood chipper after the show, and he lives in Delano, Minnesota, and every 4th of July, he leads the 4th of July parade hauling the wood chipper.
Is there a restaurant in here that where you worked as a dishwasher? Which one is it? What's it called in the...
It's where they go to talk about the ransom, Bill Macy and Harv Presnell, and the accountant.
You see the traffic in the background going by on that. They're in a booth. Yeah.
So I was going to ask you why you called this Fargo. Then I realized just the first scene is shot in Fargo. Why don't you call it Fargo? It takes place in Brainerd and...
In Minneapolis.
Minneapolis.
Yeah.
Brainerd's not a very sexy name for a movie, no, okay. Where's Mike? Quick.
Yeah, hi. How much improvisation do you tend to allow on set, and was there anything substantial that an actor improvised that made its way into Fargo?
There's not a lot of improvisation on the set, really. We rehearse with actors, and things change then, times. But when we're shooting, not really. I mean, pretty much go out there and shoot what's in the script or what's been rehearsed.
Yeah, really. Certainly in this. Marlon Wayans in Lady Killers did a lot of improvising, and that... gets a lot more laughs than the scripted stuff, which is irritating.
I was just wondering, with stuff like the Fargo show on FX and like Kumiko the Treasure Hunter being out there, just what's it like having stories that you wrote and made, and then much later on being taken into new hands, new people, I guess. Yeah.
No, it's fine. I feel like people can do whatever they want with it, within reason, I guess. I don't know. I'm more of the opinion that you kind of put something out in the culture, and then the culture kind of does what it wants with it, and you can't or shouldn't get too precious with it. I mean, it's
all odd. It's all weirdly... it's all odd, but that people go see the original movies is odd. I don't know why.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's a story about James M. Cain being asked, you know, what do you think about what they did to your book? One of the adaptations of his book, and he said, they didn't do anything to the book. It's right over there on the bookshelf. It's which I kind of think is a healthy way to sort of look at it.
You're surprised that people come back and see the older movies?
No, I'm surprised they go to any of them when they're new.
Oh.
We made movies when we were kids. Nobody paid to see them. It's odd.
You know what? We could show them here. I'm sure we'll get a minion.
Over here. You guys make extremely entertaining movies, and you seem to genuinely care about entertaining your audiences, yet here and there, some of your films have these moments where you're really, really cruel to your characters and to your audiences. The one I keep thinking of is Burn After Reading, which I absolutely love, but everyone who I know who doesn't love it loves it for the exact same reason, because of what happens to Brad Pitt. What are the rules that you kind of set up for when you decide to kind of separate the wheat from the chaff and do something really mean to your characters and potentially lose some people in the process?
You know, Yeah, people like that. Brad Pitt liked it.
I guess it was some, I don't know.
You know, we find it entertaining, and you think about the audience in the abstract, and you go, what'll get them going here? What'll be good here, you know? And I guess people's understanding of what's good here is, I mean, there are some people who don't enjoy seeing Brad Pitt getting shot in the face. So.
No spoilers here, please. The retrospective starts tomorrow. They'll burn before reading is not in the retrospective. So it's okay.
I don't know. Well, it's not calculated. You're just thinking, you know, what'll be good here? And then, like I say, it's odd. People actually agree. Some people show up and pay, apparently agreeing that it was good there.
Yeah, you think about the audience very generically, but you do think about the audience. You want it to be entertaining for an audience, but the only real sort of benchmark you have is what would be entertaining to you, you know? You make the movies that you want to see, but that haven't been made yet. So, but, you know, you're not going to appeal to everyone, so...
Do you preview your movies to audiences?
No.
Studios don't do that anymore, do they?
Well, they do, actually. They used to do it with our stuff, but it just told them nothing. So they gave up, basically.
We do show them to an audience of, like, friends, people we know, just to sort of figure out, since, you know, we know the story, obviously, you can assume that the audience will know certain things that, in fact, weirdly and surprisingly, they don't end up getting. Just, you know, expository
narrative information.
Things.
Yeah. Or is this clear? Is that clear? Is this... And also, you can sit in a room with people and you can get a vague sense of... your own reading of the tempo of the movie is different than when you're watching it by yourself. What you feel in your own body when you're watching is different if you're in a room with a lot of other people.
It's exciting to watch it with people and see it.
Yeah.
What, do you remember the first time you saw Fargo with an audience?
It may have been at, like, Cannes or something like that. It played at Cannes right after we finished it. I think so.
Yes.
Yeah. I think it was probably there that we saw it with them. But Cannes, you know, that's a strange audience,
yeah, of course,
because,
yeah.
You know.
They're French.
They're French, yeah.
What do they know from Minnesota?
You've written so many great scripts. I'm just wondering, when you have kind of the blank page when you're starting out, what kind of is the initial process? Is it a theme? Is it a character? Is it a plot line that you've decided? Where do you start usually when you're at the beginning of your writing process?
I'm trying to figure out how to describe why that's an odd question. It's, you know, we talk about stuff, maybe a character or somebody we know or a setting or a book we've read or something. And, you know, the conversation meanders here and there. And, you know, at some point in that conversation, we start writing something. But where did the actual writing start? Kind of, who knows? You can't really say. You know what I mean? We have a conversation and at some point we start writing. And the conversation can be very wide-ranging. That's why I can't really answer the question the way you put it.
I heard your interview with Terry Gross where you said you write by napping. Is that right?
Well, there's a lot of that.
How does that work?
Well, yeah, it's true that for years, Fran... my wife used to accuse me of just going down to the office to take naps, and I would say it wasn't true, but in fact it is true.
Where's the mic?
Hi? Oh, okay, good. So for the first, say, third of this movie, all of the characters are incompetent or malevolent or both. And then Frances McDormand comes in, and she's like a beaming force of good. So it kind of stands in contradistinction to a classic noir where the person who fixes everything is also tied up in everything. Does that make sense, and is it an interesting thing to talk about? Sorry if it's not.
it is. Well, here's something. I'm maybe exaggerating a little, but I'm not sure that we thought of Fran as being the good guy.
She actually thought she... Fran thought that character was the scariest person in the movie.
I think we really thought of Steve Buscemi as being the kind of sane person in an insane world. I kind of...
But I know what you mean. It is true that she's the one who sort of... I do know... Is that what... I guess that you were saying that usually in noir the protagonist is tied up or implicated somehow in the sort of the goings on. I guess that's true sometimes. Although Chandler was, you know, Marlowe is not exactly that. He's kind of, in a way, he's the you know, the moral center of the movie.
Well, we like this sort of crime story, and then, like, you know, builds to a kind of climax, and then ping, you're somewhere else, and the person is unbelievably benign, and there was something, it's kind of like the question before, there's something to us that was appealing about that, so we thought, okay, that's, for whatever reason, which we didn't stop to talk about, appealing, so we're doing that.
But yeah, you know, I mean, it's harder to... When you think about this and things like this, and you think about, okay, you're doing a crime story, or you're doing a detective story, or whatever it happens to be, we tend to go a little bit, usually, in the opposite direction of what the sort of convention is. So, or at least do something with the convention that... So, you know, in The Big Lebowski, it was sort of, okay, that's kind of a Chandler story, but... It was just more interesting to us that it was being, you know, whatever had to be figured out was being figured out by a character that was sort of befogged by dope. It just was... So there's a little bit of that, I guess, going on here, too. We were doing a crime story, and we thought, all right, well, what would be a little different here?
Okay, so I've seen this movie a lot, and one thing that stuck out to me is, so what's the deal with the Accordion King poster? Was that something that existed, or did you make that? And if so, what direction did you give for that poster?
That's a really good question.
It is a good question, and we welcome it. The guy is actually the transportation captain, Mike Kennedy. We just, for some reason, we were looking at Mike and we thought, Lederhosen, man.
Really, it was pretty much that. It really was. And I think he was a little suspicious at first. This is a transportation, you know, teamster. And we said, could you put on Lederhosen and hold an accordion for us?
It surprised me, probably you, he kind of got into
it. He did, yeah. It's one of the great things about making movies. You can do that.
Has that ever been revealed?
Tim Ryan, another transportation captain, is in The Big Lebowski when John Turturro is going door to door to tell his neighbors that he's a child molester. We thought he should knock on Tim Ryan's door.
We should make a movie with entirely acted by transportation captains.
Don Tardino, the picture car coordinator,
is also in The Big Lebowski.
Naked Woman on the Beach.
In The Big Lebowski. So yeah, it does run through.
Yeah.
Good question.
Joel, you responded a few questions back talking about connecting with audience and about how you always want to tell a story that hasn't been told. I'm just curious, where does the impetus come from for things like Lady Killers and True Grit?
Yeah, you got me there. Okay. Lady Killers is a little complicated. It was the genesis of that was that we were asked to write that for another director, who then sort of fell out of the movie, and the studio asked us if we would do it, and we said okay. So it was sort of came at that for a little from the sort of different direction than we usually do. True Grit. That was interesting. We were aware of the fact there had been a movie made of that before, but I had I actually didn't really remember it very well. I guess I saw it in 1960, whenever it was, 3 or 4 or 5, but 9. Okay, yeah. I had read. We both read the book because we both liked Charles Portis, but I had read it out loud to my kid when he was little, and thought, this will make a good movie. I knew it had been made, but I thought, well, we could do something with this. That's how that happened.
So, clearly, you guys are pretty forward-looking in that you don't look back at your films. I think it's clear that you guys have an established style and established, you know, a sense that, like, this is, you know, a Coen Brothers movie. But how do you feel that you've changed and grown, like, within that? How has that morphed over the years? Has that been intentional? And, you know, what's kind of just changed that you didn't really realize was happening, and you're like, oh, that's cool, we're doing things differently?
Yeah, the latter.
Okay.
Yeah. It's just like everything else in life. You just go from one thing to the next, and then you go, okay, that's what happened.
Also, I must say, to the extent that the movies share anything, it's in spite of our efforts, you want to do something different. You know what I mean? It's not like you want to apply something uniform to each of them. You have a different... You know, what's exciting about a new idea for a story is that it's new. You know what I mean? Then you try to do justice to that as opposed to apply something external to it.
What's the biggest disagreement you've had in your respective visions for a particular movie?
You know... Storyboarding, we frequently, this is interesting, assume totally different things about left-right, which is, you know, totally arbitrary. But, you know, when he says the character enters from the right and you just, like, know it's wrong because in your head. And, you know, vice versa. And, you know, the storyboarder is
really tired of it. Yeah. Yeah. Looks at it. Okay. Which is it? Is he facing this way or is he facing that way?
That's it.
And you're not supposed to do this. It's the first rule in the manual when they, you know, in the secret ceremony where they let in the director's guild. We crossed the line once in Inside Llewyn Davis, and probably we have before, but nobody will ever notice. You would never know. That's apropos of nothing.
We're talking about, right, when you're shooting some scene and you have to establish an axis that you're shooting on it, so that the screen directions can be consistent when you go to close-up, so that you're... You know, if one character is looking right, the other has to be looking left. But you have to choose the sort of side of the line that you're on. You have to know what the axis is.
We were in the middle of cutting the scene, and I actually noticed. I said, Joe, you know, both of the characters are looking right.
It's in the movie. We did do it before. It can get confusing. We did it in Raising Arizona, remember?
That was three people.
Yeah. And then you sit around for a couple of hours scratching your head trying to figure out, okay, well, what kind of coverage do we need to make this work? I don't know why we've gone off on this. It's a very technical kind of, nobody's interested. But.
There's one guy interested. What's the name of your film editor again?
Roderick James.
He's over 100, I hear.
He will be now.
He's done all your pictures, yeah.
Yeah.
One more great question.
Hey.
Oh,
so,
I guess that's it.
You guys have made... just got this. You guys have made so many films over so many years, and you...
You speak
often,
up a little bit.
Oh, sorry. There it is. And you often seem to work with the same people. So I'm wondering, what sort of qualities do you see in these people that make you say, well, I really need to work with this person? You know, just besides that, besides the fact that they look good in Lederhosen.
It is true. We work with a lot of the same people over and over again, both actors and, you know, a lot of the people in the credits of this movie we've been working with, we were working with long before we made this movie, and we're still working with. What are the qualities you look for? I mean, it's just like any other, sometimes you're right, sometimes you're wrong, but when you find a sort of congenial collaboration, you stick with it, or we do anyway. And that's what making movies is a, you know, it's a social endeavor. It's not, it's all about working with other people. So, I mean, that's just the nature of little enterprise. I don't really know how to answer that, except you find people who are just very congenial, the point of view that you need into working just personally, and are brilliant at what they do. That's all.
You want to add to that, Ethan?
No.
In which case, well, thank you very much. And... it was worth missing the Republican debates for this, I think. We want to remind everyone that tomorrow we begin our Coen Brothers Festival with Barton Fink and a late show of Lebowski. Don't leave yet. And their new movie, Hail Caesar, opens next Friday, but we're having a special, I think it's sold out already, screening of Hail Caesar here next Thursday. Thanks again.
Thank you for listening to Film Forum's podcast. Visit us online at filmforum.org, where you can learn more about our films, memberships, subscribe to our free weekly e-newsletter, and to find out the ways you can support our nonprofit cinema. And if you have the time, please visit our iTunes page and leave a rating and review of our podcast. Copyright to this program belongs to The Moving Image Incorporated.